Yeah, I am Ben Wilson. I am an alcoholic. I'm extremely sensitive, and you have no idea how sensitive, because otherwise you wouldn't have had a vote in front of me as to whether to take the collection before I spoke or afterwards. It shows a certain lack of confidence in the speaker. I mean, I have spoken before when they've taken the collection prior to me getting up, but they've always had the vote in private. This time they voted unanimously in front of me to get the money and run. Dear God. I said I'm an alcoholic. Did we want to the second Sunday in Lent? That's probably all right. I'm English by birth, I'm Irish by disease, Scotch by absorption, and American by adoption. I've been sober a long time. I haven't had a drink since December the 12th, 1970, and haven't taken any pills prescribed for me or for anybody else during that time. Things have got better, and then they've got worse, and then they really got shitty. And then they get better again. It is remarkable what happens. If we don't drink and come to meetings and do all that stuff. My mind's gone dead again. I have a short-term attention span, and my mind is badly broken, so there's no sequence about this. I just start talking, and the criteria I normally use is that when more people are leaving than are coming in, I'll sit down. If the secretary waves their watch at me, I'll wave mine back. I like to tell you that I drank. It's really important. Because there are people who start their pitch and say, I don't want to talk about drinking. I want to talk more about sobriety. And you know you're in for the longest drunkalogue that ever happened. I've never heard that fail to happen. You know, we're going to talk about the spiritual side of the program. And then they talk about drinking and football or something. I loved booze. I really did love booze. It did for me what I couldn't do right up until the last drink I ever took. I am not of the school that says that drink stopped working. If it stopped working, I'd have stopped drinking it. It worked perfectly on the criteria. And it's important to get the right criteria. We have badly broken brains. When I got the criteria right, which was, is it going to be better to drink or to not drink for the next 10 minutes, then I always took the drink, and it was always better than not taking it. Not better than some other person's standard, like, you know, they didn't get into fights. Well, I might take the drink and get into a fight, but it was still better than not taking the drink. And if you understand that, you're probably in the right place. I come from I'm English by birth. I did all my drinking east of New York, or a very long way west of here, depending which way you're going. I'm the guy who's took the cork out of the bottle and threw it in the fireplace and said, we shan't be needing that. There was nothing conservative about my drinking. I loved it. It took me to places I couldn't get to on my own. Sobriety has taken me to places I couldn't get to on my own, too. Oh, dear God. I hate to sort of be a, you know, I'm not a good example of somebody who's been sober as long as I have, really. I mean, I've done everything I did drinking since I got sober, except I haven't killed anybody since 1955. And that's the only difference. I've wanted to kill a lot of people since I got sober. Just haven't had the opportunity. I quit stealing into sobriety, when I got fed up with taking the money back. And that's how the program works. If you're new and you're listening to people who say but this is an honest program. Tell them to read the goddamn book. It doesn't say where it's an honest program. It says we have to grasp and develop a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. That's very different from an honest program. I was about to swear, and I shall swear, but I'll try not to use the F word. And I'll tell you why. It's nothing to do with cleaning up my mouth. Big Book says that we describe spirituality in everyday language. So this is not a clean up your mouth program. However, I try not to say the F word. And this is about the last 7 years. About 7 years ago, I was in Benicia. It was Christmas. They had a meeting like this. It was wonderful. I was wonderful. You know, it was just one of those evenings. It was really superb. And as I come down, the secretary thanked me, and he then comes to make an announcement. He said, "Does anybody here drive a black Jaguar?" Well, I wanted everybody to know I had a black Jaguar, so I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, a tree has fallen on it." Well, I'd used the F word at least twice that night, so now, particularly when I fly to a meeting, I really try not to use the F word. And tonight, Kevin picked me up at the motel. We left the new one back at Motel 6. No trees anywhere near it. It should be all right. So that's why I try not to use the F word. I shall probably fail, but no one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect appearance. When I was a kid, I was brought up I'm not going to tell you that I was brought up in a dysfunctional family. I'm going to tell you about the dysfunctional families that I started, because that's important. We get well that way. Talking about the one we come from doesn't improve our lives. There are some things. You know, I'm going to share experience, strength, and hope liberally scattered with opinions and advice. And that's how spiritual it gets, you know? I mean, maybe the most spiritual thing I can do is to tell you that I haven't had a drink or a mind-bending pill of any sort for 31 years. And you don't have to be wonderful, witness me, in order to do that. You don't have to get pure, thank God. But I just got the final papers on my fourth divorce 2 weeks ago. And I'll tell you, divorce gets easier. I mean, I have been divorced several times sober. And it gets easier. We did not have a crossword throughout the process. She's sober several years. And we just got through it. Okay. I mean, you have to do it a lot, but we get better at it. When I got sober, I'm a high-bottom drunk, and I want you to know this. It's not because I'm wearing a tie or anything like that. This is always the sign of the speaker, particularly when you get a long way from San Francisco, pick the speaker up because they're wearing a tie. But I'm a high-bottom drunk because I took my last drink on the fourth floor of a maximum security penitentiary. And that's my claim to being a high-bottom. Guy, a sponsor, came up to me after a meeting one day and he said, "We're all high-bottom drunks." And I said, "How do you manage to work that out, Pat?" And he said, "Well, we've buried all the low-bottom drunks." And that's probably true. We bury a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and a lot of people get buried that we don't hear about. I don't know what the statistics are. People talk about statistics. I love the statistics in the Big Book. Rarely have we seen a person fail who's thoroughly followed our path. Practical experience shows us that nothing so much ensures immunity against drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. If you don't work with other alcoholics will get to work with you. Uh-huh. I've got a sponsor who does real well. And I found him at a meeting about 200 yards from Big Ben. And he was wearing a bootlace tie, plaid jacket, and cowboy boots, and you could tell he wasn't a native. Came from a place called Bartlesville, Oklahoma, and he was explaining to me that Tulsa was a suburb of Bartlesville, and you have an idea maybe of who he worked for. And he was the chief engineer of one of the largest oil companies in the world. And that's the guy I went to when I needed to get relief from this mania that I had. And he did aha. I would call him and he would listen to me and go, aha. And he has about 100 different forms of aha. And one day I'm in his office having a cup of coffee and I watched him do aha to somebody else. He was checking drilling reports. He'd put the telephone down on the desk in front of him and he's going, aha, aha. And when the telephone stopped speaking, he picked it up and talked to the guy. And on the worst day in my sobriety, I'll tell you about this, it has not all been wonderful. I moved to Oklahoma City from Sacramento, 1983, in pursuit of power, property, prestige, and lust. And she threw me out. I don't like to tell that part of it. And so I called Paul Shamer, his name is, lives in Arkansas now. And we use our last names at meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, so you can find us. I'm in the San Francisco telephone directory. You can find me. Strange. These people call from hotels and nursing homes and hospitals and leave messages that Jack W. has called. You can't get through to Jack W. at the Hilton. You cannot get through to Jack W. in a hospital. They don't know who he is. Why are we so anonymous? Dr. Bob says if you're not willing to give your last name at a meeting, you are as guilty of breaking the tradition of anonymity as people who give their name out at the media level. Strange. My theory is that I'd be crazy to come here and trust you with my life and not tell you what my last name is. That's my reason for doing it. So, there I am in Oklahoma City, thrown out by this young woman. She was much younger than me. And I called Paul. And I'm crying. I hate to tell you that. And he said, it sounds like you're having a great day. And I said, don't give me that shit. And he said, have you had a drink? And I said, no, I have not had a drink. He said, sounds like a fantastic day to me for a drunk of your type. I've not had a drink by 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And then he listened to me and did the aha game. And right at the end, maybe half an hour later, I'm telling him all the troubles and I've got to leave this house and I don't know where to live and all this stuff. He picked up the telephone and he said, I don't have any experience to share with you. I mean, I didn't know that it had been on the desk. I should have known because I'd watched it before, but I'm slow to learn. And he said, I don't have any experience to share with you and I don't believe in advice, so this is an instruction. Listen good. He said, I want you to go to a meeting tonight. I want you to find somebody who's newer than you are, who's having a worse day than you are. You work with them, call me in the morning. He hung up on me. I had a dial tone in my ear from a man who loves me more than I love me. But the other day, I was walking to the mailbox, and there was an erstwhile member of my Saturday morning, too early on Saturday morning at 8 o'clock, group of Alcoholics Anonymous in the city of San Francisco. He was standing there. I said, how are you doing? He said, okay. Where have you been? He said, where have you been to me? And I said, well, what meetings are you going to? And he said, well, I'm not going to meetings now. I called him a selfish son of a bitch. Crossed the road, put my package in the mailbox. He was still waiting there hailing a cab, so I had a second go at him on the return journey. Told him he was a taker and a loser and went back to the office. And I got back to the office and a few minutes after I got in, some nameless person, I didn't catch his name, called me up and said, 14 years ago, he said, you told me to go to a meeting, find somebody who's newer than me, having a worse day than me, and to work with them, and you hung up on me. I said, oh, did I? And he said, yes. He said, absolutely changed my life. I'm calling up to thank you. I said, That's prompt, 14 years, isn't it? So, what we're doing is what we're doing. Neither good nor bad. The guy I insulted, who was calling the cab, is back as a newcomer at my home group. He doesn't talk to me yet. But I'm here for the long haul. And, it's just great. This may not be good. Well, we have some newcomers. This may not be good news for you. But 24 years sober, I was thinking a lot about suicide. Thinking a lot about suicide. Went to a meeting every day for 2 weeks and talked about wanting to commit suicide. Because they've told me always to take my problems to Alcoholics Anonymous. Not take the mask, take the real person and share it. So I'm talking about wanting to commit suicide. And a woman came up to me after this meeting, after 14 days, and she said, "How are you doing?" She obviously hadn't heard a word I said. And I said, "I just want to burst into tears and jump off a cliff." And walked on, left her without a lot of hope. And I was talking to this old sponsor of mine, Paul Shaner, and he'd called me because I was speaking for him at a conference where he was the chairman. And I was the kickoff speaker the following week on the Friday. I was going to fly to Arkansas and speak at the springtime in the Ozarks. He's telling me that they've got the schedule printed, the program was printed with my name in it, and I'm telling him I want to commit suicide. It's not good news for the guy who's trying to run this conference with a speaker who's featured there and got his name in the program, and I'm telling him I want to commit suicide. And he just sort of cuts through the stuff, and he said, "Bennett, are you still going to lots of meetings?" I said, "Yes, Paul, I am." He said, "Are you still sponsoring lots of people?" And I said, "Yes, Paul, I am." He said, "Well, that's all you can do." And he started talking about how we were going to play golf when I got to Arkansas. And I thought, he has no sensitivity at all. He really does not take my case as an individual case. It's just that same shit for everybody stuff, Go and work with those goddamn newcomers and stuff. And that's all you can do, he said. And about 4 hours later, after the resentment subsided, I realized that one more time he'd saved my life, because that's all we can do. And I hear a lot of people dealing with the issues. We have step six up there, which is exactly the opposite of dealing with the issue. Doesn't mean I don't try and deal with the issues, but every time I look at that, it tells me not to. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. What a flash. No work for me at all. Get out of the goddamn way. Incredible stuff. I used to smoke. I want to talk about this just for a moment. I've taken pills too. If anybody's sensitive about that, read the goddamn book. Does not talk about drugs for 6 whole pages. Six whole pages before it talks about dope in there. Except, of course, that it talks about pot on the first page of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Anyway, I smoked. I smoked a lot. And on December the 31st, 1973, I woke up and said to myself, I may not smoke ever again. I smoked 4 packs a day for a long time. Called a guy later on that morning who'd been sober then for over 26 years, and I said, "You drank like me, you must have smoked like me." And he told me what he'd done. He hadn't had a cigarette for 21 years. Told me what to do, how to take inventory. And I followed the instructions. Had the 5 worst days of my sobriety. Went back to work on the 4th day. It was January the 2nd or 3rd, whatever it was. I'm a civil engineer and I built pipelines. That's the thing I was at that time. And went back to work, and I'd fired 2 men before breakfast. And one of my foremen is following me around with a packet of cigarettes saying, "Governor, smoke for God's sake. There won't be any of us left at lunchtime." Well, on the 5th day, I said the 7th step or my version of the seventh step out loud on the telephone in front of God and another member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, "Dear God, in all humility, I ask you to remove this addiction I have to nicotine. I haven't wanted a cigarette for 1 second in the next 28 plus years. This has nothing to do with quitting smoking, but I believe it has to do with God giving me confidence in the seventh step. And if it's ever that desperate again, it will be that effective again." Well, when it's desperate, I get the answers in desperation. It's time for me to talk about depression, which is an unpopular subject around here. If you're depressed, you're in the right place. If you're new, you should be very depressed. It's depressing being an Alcoholics Anonymous. Now I want to quote the big book again. I don't have page numbers, but it's in there. It says, "Twisted thinking and depression will not leave in a twinkling. All of those of you who are rushing to doctors to cure your depression, read the book. Because depression is the precursor of despair. And despair is wonderful. Without despair, I'm not sure that I'd have ever found the God of my understanding today. A terrible depression, without suicidal depression, in sobriety, I would have not have been in sufficient despair to surrender. Again, again and again." And really, that's the story of my sobriety. It's been great events happening, terrible down. And if I can just categorize my sobriety, it's now into the fourth decade. The first decade was frantic, just frantic. I frantically worked, I frantically stayed sober, I frantically went to meetings, I frantically started lots of meetings. A group of us started the old primary purpose group down in Sacramento that some of you may remember. We did frantic things. I frantically got into relationships, frantically got laid, frantically did things. And then after about 10 years, it changed a little bit. And the next decade was overcoming regret. That's really important, to overcome regret. You know, we go around with all this baggage about if only. That's one of the phrases my sponsor put in the cover of my big book. He wrote "if only" and put a line through it. Then put "but" and put a line through, and "never" and "forever" and all those other words like "should" and a line through. Wonderful stuff. Those sponsors give us. Give us this ability to say, the ability to do things, that ability to be free of regret has been a tremendous freedom. The third decade, from 20 to 30, was saying, "Thank you, God, for the seemingly bad." You know, I love gratitude lists. It's great. You've just arrived here from treatment. It's probably about all you can do. And that's great. But we have to move on. And I believe the moving on is writing the ungrateful list. Write the list of what we are ungrateful for and get grateful for it. Because it's what we got. I have a belief, and I got it from a brand newcomer who he just raised his hand as less than 30 days sober, and he said, "If you want to feel better, quit complaining." I've been using this for the next 15 years. And there is a principle which if you complain about something, it will get worse. Absolutely guaranteed to get worse. And if you're grateful for it, it's guaranteed to get better. Now, isn't that incredible stuff? We have to go through this terrible pain to get to that point. And this started when I was 30 years sober. I made a decision, one more decision, that I was going to act as if I wasn't afraid. And it's been a year and a half nearly of acting as if I wasn't afraid. I was able to walk out of a 5-year marriage as if I wasn't afraid. Tell you what I did. I mean, I'm sitting there in my chair. meditating on this particular Saturday morning. She was going out of town to a retreat, and I knew that I could move out, get the furniture out, be in my new apartment, not say a word to her, and be gone before she came back from this retreat. That was a good plan. It was a really good plan, and I, you know, it was like getting the regiment on the move in the morning. I mean, it was just like the military. I had it down. I knew what I was going to do. I finished my meditation. I walked into the kitchen. She walked into the kitchen. I said, I'm going to leave. I can't stand it anymore. That was 5 minutes after I'd told God my plan. And there I was, acting as if I wasn't afraid. And it's interesting, just to share a little bit around this. The previous September, I had said that I was going to go and visit this old sponsor of mine in Arkansas. He's getting old. He's nearly 80. He's 38 years sober. And he's an old man. And I thought I'd just go and spend some time with him. And on December the 12th of the year 2000, I had my 30th birthday, and I was going to share at a small meeting in Oakland. And they moved it that week to a room about this size, and they packed it with guys, most of whom I sponsored. And this, you know, it was an incredible event. And they are, you know, they introduced me, and I came up to speak, and they'd flown Paul Shaner from Arkansas to come up and give me my 30-year chip. And wow, you know. And remember, if you're new, it may be 20-something years before that happens for you. But anyway, I'd made this plan in September. I bought the ticket in February, made the decision to walk out of my marriage at the end of March, got on a plane the first week in April, having arrived in this new apartment of mine and done one more fourth step. 30 years of sobriety does not get you immunity against fourth steps. I thought it should. It didn't. I sat there. I know I can do a fourth step real fast now because I've shown hundreds of people how to do it. And there's not that much of updating. But what I do have to update is real important. And I got on that airplane and got to Arkansas, and Paul and I played golf three or four times, and I took my fifth step walking the fairways of golf courses in Arkansas. And that had all started, the plan for that had started the previous September. That's my long-winded way of explaining that God had something to do with this. And I believe in looking for the hand of God in whatever's happening. I know that there are cynics and jaded people who don't believe in the parking God. I believe in the parking God. Under the following conditions. That when I get a parking space from the parking God, I say thank you. When I find one and she backs into it first, I say thank you, God. When I don't find a parking space, I say thank you, God. And then the parking God is very valid. When I was new, about 3 months sober, I'm sitting in an AA meeting, and this jerk was speaking. You know the jerks when you're new? Know absolutely nothing. He said, if you want to have a better day, let two vehicles into the line of traffic ahead of you in the morning. I did not have a driver's license, didn't have a car. I didn't know what the hell he was talking about. 31 years later, it worked today. It works every day I let two cars into the line of traffic ahead of me. Incredible stuff. You know, we're not that important, and we're certainly not that much hurry. You know, I mean, there isn't a drink at the end of this drive. Hello. Hello. I have a computer in my car, and I can zero the trip at any time. And, you know, that's great to be able to begin the trip again at any time. Start the day any time. Start the year any time. There are tricks. And all the tricks have to do with this spiritual stuff. You know, I don't believe in the God I didn't believe in when I got sober. Really have trouble with him. I came out of the penitentiary, as I said. My first day in freedom was relative freedom. I was in a treatment center. And I came downstairs, and there was a line at the nursing station on my 37th birthday. And I was the oldest 37-year-old you've ever known. And you can do the math. 31 years later, I'm the youngest 68-year-old you'll ever know. Well, I play a lot of golf. I carry my own bag. I do a lot of stuff. And I'm young. And somebody said, "Do you still work?" And I said, "No, I'm a real estate broker. But I have an office, and it's a place I go to. And sometimes I do things." Anyway, I come downstairs at this treatment center, and there's this long line at the nursing station for the stuff. Well, I don't know what I'm going to get, so I walk to the front of the line, look over the nurse's shoulder, and my last name is Wilson, W-I-L-S-O-N. I know exactly where it is on the list. Look at the bottom of the list. I've been missed off the list. Clerical error, I get nothing. Pissed off, I go into breakfast. May not be a big deal to you, but this is why you got this speaker. It was a woman called Mary who'd been left off the list, and 1 year later, we were the only two sober. There were 38 of us. 36 had been taking the stuff, medically indicated stuff. This is my database. No opinion whatsoever. 5 of them were dead and 31 were drunk, and Mary and I were sober 1 year later. That's my experience. I don't know if it has any correlation. I owed a lot of money when I got sober, and this old sponsor of mine, I never thought he was really very clever. He was probably one of the world's greatest experts in oil exports. This is the important thing. We were looking for this meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You don't have to find the meeting. You just have to look for them. I have a daughter who's in Al-Anon. She's a black belt Al-Anon, been in Al-Anon for longer than I want to tell you. And we were talking one day, and when she was fairly new, and I said, you know, she was complaining about a bad meeting. And incidentally, if you've never been to a bad AA meeting, you haven't been to nearly enough meetings. Not nearly enough. I've been to a lot of bad AA meetings, I'll tell you. I've been to a lot of meetings. And I was explaining to her that the value of the meeting is in the commitment, not in the content. If you get to the meeting, it's okay. Doesn't matter what happens. And I was in a meeting in Laramie, Wyoming, the year before last. The speaker had been drunk the night before, and he wasn't the newest guy in the meeting. And there were 5 of us. I believe in service. I read that book, or at least I read the second edition of that book in the penitentiary. Some things happened after my last drink. I drank half a bottle of wine late November 1970. Haven't had a drink since. Not the day I celebrate, because I was in the joint, and things happened. I read the second edition of the book. It says God a lot. I can't read the word God and concentrate. So I'd read the word God and my eyes would drop a few lines. God, drop. You read it very quickly that way. Page 32 doesn't mention God. Have to read the whole damn page. Talks about the guy who was 30 years old, had a lot of trouble with spree drinking. Don't know if anybody identifies with spree drinking. I don't. That he'd stayed off the booze for 25 years, started drinking. 3 years later, he's dead. I said, "Ben, you must never ever drink again." The next day, the profound experience was that I followed the instruction of the book. What I remember from the book was, we don't drink, we help other people to not drink, and we call it Alcoholics Anonymous. I walked the exercise yard of the oldest penitentiary in England the next morning, and I said to Ralph, "If you and I join Alcoholics Anonymous, we need never come back here." Now, if I'd met any of you before that, I would never have done that. Because, you know, AAs would have dissuaded me from my first 12-step course. They would have said I was too new. and I couldn't give away what I didn't have. I gave away what I had, which was incredible hope, and haven't taken a drink since. I was there when Ralph was discharged. 2 years later, I was parked outside the jail he came out of. I hitchhiked halfway across England to 12-step him again one day and spent the whole day hitchhiking. During that time, I watched a race on television. I was brought up with horse racing, and we had racehorses at home, and my best friend was a racehorse trainer, and I'm watching BBC television, and Tim trained the winner of the big race that afternoon, and I'm watching him being interviewed, and he's smiling and laughing, and the jockey's unsaddling the winner, and he pats him on the top of the head as he walks past, and I'm sitting on a hard back chair in the prison chapel, and I said, for the first time in my life, there's something wrong with you, Ben. This is not bad luck. It had been bad luck right up till that moment. And so things happened. They happened whilst I was in the joint. They happened after I came out. I read that book, and it has some instructions in there. It says, go and tell your doctor about your disease and ask for referrals. Get some blank looks when I say that. The other day I was saying it, and I thought, oh, God, this is 3 or 4 years ago. When I say the other day, it's a relative term. I'd better go and remind my doctor about my membership of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'm there for my six-monthly checkup, and I said, Francis, you remember I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you get any drunks you can't handle, call me. And he said, yeah, Ben, and da-da-da. And I sort of felt bad, you know, that I'd exposed myself one more time and da-da-da. 2 weeks later, he calls me up and said, Ben, do you think you could sell that building of mine downtown? I said, yeah, Francis, I think I can. And so here was me feeling that I had become less than, and there's this doctor trusting me with selling his building, and we did another one later on. And out of that little conversation came quite a lot of money, actually. I mean, bad to mix money and sobriety, isn't it? Oh, dear, oh, me. It tells me about jails in there and people. And so I was elected the chairman of Public Information and Hospitals and Institutions Committee in my hometown in England when I was 6 weeks sober. Now, I know there are people here who would say I was probably too new for the job. And you would have been right, except that I was the only person sober in that city. So I got the job without an election. I've never won an election in Alcoholics Anonymous. I get jobs as secretary out of default. That's all I can do. I never win a popularity contest. Anyway, I go into the police station in Chelmsford in Essex with my girlfriend, non-alcoholic girlfriend. She was 24 years old. She had been arrested the same night as I. But she was non-alcoholic. She just drank with me and was led, you know, she was led astray by this elder gentleman. That's me. But she came into the police station to give me moral support, and I'm talking to the sergeant. Now, the sergeant knows who I am. My family have lived in that city for a long time. We're just outside, and my father's a fairly prominent businessman in the city, and I've been involved in sport at the major league level, and I'd had my picture on the front page of the newspaper several times, and he knew who I was. The last time it said, cavalry officer jailed for fraud. I mean, he knew who I was. And I'm saying to him, in my arrogance, 6 weeks sober, I said, if you have any drunks that you can't handle, I'm your guy. I'm talking to the jailer. You know, I mean, he knows how to handle drunks with a boot in the ass and lock them up. I'm saying I've got a better answer. And he's nodding and, you know, he's being polite. English law enforcement, very polite until they go past that go and then watch out. And just as we're doing this, and I'm giving him my telephone number, she passed out drunk on the police station floor behind me. Now, you would think that this was an inappropriate public information presentation when one of the two members passes out drunk and I'm telling him about, you know, I mean, you'd think it was inappropriate. But I just want to bring you up to date. We have between us 58 years of continuous sobriety, she and I. She didn't get sober right away, but she's been sober now a long, long time. And if you're new, I want to encourage you to do this thing wrong. Please do it wrong. I mean, really, really please do it really wrong. And then stay sober long enough to help and show other people how to do it right. Because if you want to understand this program, explain it to other people. I didn't do the fourth step right. I don't know, when do we want to finish? I mean, is there a curfew here? Meeting ends at 9. Oh, we're in good shape. We got time to get through the 12 steps. We can probably talk about the traditions. Maybe get into the concepts. I've told you about my first step anyway. The second step, I walked into an AA meeting and I came there to listen to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, believing that it could restore me to a sanity where I didn't have to drink even if I wanted to. So everybody here has taken the first and second step. I was 11 months sober and I took the third step. I said to the closet, "Hey you, I know you're not there. I know that this won't work, but just as an experiment, please you do the not drinking for me tomorrow. Haven't had a drink since." Then I got on to the fourth step. And I sat in an AA meeting looking at those steps. And they will blow your mind if you haven't done them. I mean, just look at the labels. God, they make me feel guilty just to look at them. Because I know that you should read between the lines. And the fourth step talks about moral and means immoral. I mean, you know and I know that they're too sensitive to put immoral in writing on the wall. But they mean immoral. So I think it's a requirement of membership of Alcoholics Anonymous to admit immorality. Well, I've never done anything immoral. I mean, I had these 135 offenses when I was in the penitentiary, but I'd never done anything immoral. And I'm sitting there in an AA meeting thinking I shan't be able to join because I haven't. And then I got it. You see, I remembered that I used to give bad checks to hookers. And I haven't had a drink since. My next fourth step, I wrote out the seven deadly sins, but only the initials, because I didn't want anybody to know and find this piece of paper. And I cross-referenced the people and put check marks in between. And I kept this for about 3 hours, I suppose, and then I shredded it in case anybody broke the code. And I haven't taken a drink since. And I then wrote The Great English Novel, which is a little longer than The Great American Novel and rather better written. And I haven't taken a drink since. 3 years sober, I'm standing outside a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and a guy called Sam comes up to me and he said, "Ben, I'm going to drink tomorrow. What are we going to do about it?" And I said, "Absolutely nothing. What are you going to do about it?" And then I changed and I said, "Sam, you need to do the fourth and fifth step and I'll show you how." Without benefit of a fourth step of my own out of the big book, I showed Sam how to do it. It's very simple. Follow the instructions. I told Sam what the instructions were. He wrote, I read. We did the fifth step as we went along. Took most of Saturday and half of Sunday. Don't think Sam's had a drink since. I haven't seen him for many years, but you know, he was sober the last time I saw him. And the brewmeister had said in a meeting that I heard him speak in Denver, Colorado, he said, "If you want to understand this program, explain it to somebody else." And on the Monday, I gave a big book to a man I used to work for, and I'm explaining Alcoholics Anonymous to him, and I went into one of these alcoholic depressions that I was talking about earlier. I better explain what an alcoholic depression is. In my opinion, 2 minutes of bad news, 23 hours and 58 minutes of replay. Replay. And so there am I. I forced Sam to write what I'd been unprepared to write. and I'm in this depression. So I get out the big book and I start to write, and haven't taken a drink since. Now the fifth step, I had done fifth steps without the benefit of the fourth step. That's wrong. Haven't taken a drink since. I'd done three fifth steps before I did a fourth step out of the big book. I want to tell you how my most recent pigeon is. I went to a meeting on Tuesday night of this week, and there was a guy at his first ever meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. He was surrounded by people handing him their card. I handed him my card. I got his telephone number. I've been here a long time. I got his number. I called him the next morning. I'm driving over the bridge on the telephone. It's, you know, it's boring in the traffic. So I talked to pigeons on the car radio, on the car telephone. And halfway through, he says to me, "Well, what's a sponsor?" So I explain it's somebody you don't like who's doing what you can't do, and etc., etc. And he said, "How do you get one?" I said, "I tell you what I'll do. I'll do it until you find somebody better." Well, he called me at lunchtime today. He'd followed the instruction. The first instruction, well, we did the first three steps. 5 minutes is the maximum time to take the first three steps. We said the prayer. We went back to step one, then did step two. Less than 5 minutes. Prayer takes 23 seconds, said slowly. Bottom of page 63, it says next. Does not say after you've been to the bathroom, when you come back from vacation. So he starts writing. I explain to him what I want him to do. I have to do this very carefully, specifically. Go and buy a green spiral-bound notebook, 8.5 by 11. He said, "I've got a white one." I said, "You didn't hear me. Buy a green one." And he said, "Why?" I said, "White ones don't work." So he says, "Why?" I said, "Well, it's because it's your idea. The green one is my idea. That's why it'll work." He called me on the way up from Berkeley this morning. He's in the parking lot during his break with a green spiral-bound notebook. He hasn't had a drink for 48 hours. And he's writing down his resentments against people, institutions, and principles. He's written about his mother. He's written about his father, and he's written about his wife during his break in the parking lot. You see, we don't have to wait until we get well in order to take the steps. We take the steps in order to get well. You know, I mean, St. Thomas's Hospital, 1935, they took Bill D's inventory for him. He was less than 24 hours off the booze. Took his inventory for him. Remember that. People who say take your own inventory, they come from treatment. That is not Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous says if you want what we have, well, in order to know what we have, you have to take our inventory. Take my inventory, you'll know whether you want what I have. If you want what I have, do what I do. Simple stuff. They took Bill D's inventory. He said, "I think I'd like to join you." They said, "That's great." Now, it's not Alcoholics Anonymous in 158 countries, spiritual program with 12 steps and all that jazz. It's the Bill and Bob Show, and they're both there. So they said, "That's good. Get out of bed, get dressed, go and find somebody who wants this thing and needs it, and bring him back to us." They sent him on a 12-step call before the booze was out of his system. Not one of those three guys ever took another drink. Remember that. We take the steps to get well, not get well to take the steps. I like to quote some of those old guys. There's a guy called Paul Stanley, who was AA number 5. And he said, "You don't have to be drunk to be useless in Alcoholics Anonymous." So we're into the fifth step. Of course, at the end of the fourth step, there are parts which people miss. I love to ask people who've been sober a long time and then drunk again some of the things they may have missed out of the fourth step. If you've taken the Joe and Charlie excerpts, you've probably missed this part because they've butchered it. They put in words that will not work. How can you have respectable and sex in the same sentence as an alcoholic of my type? I cannot take a fourth step if you say respectable and sex in the same sentence. The other bit that people miss is the ideal sex life. Now, there'll be some blank looks in the room. It says ideal five times on page 69 and 70. I believe it means it. Five times. I got six guys to work with 3 years ago who'd all been over 10 years sober, one of them nearly 20 years sober. They were all drunk and new. And I asked them the questions. Have you ever done the fourth step out of the big book? Smattering of yeses, a couple of yeses, four noes. Ever dealt with the ideal sex life? 6, 0 for 6 there. But the really big 0 for 6 was, have you ever shown anybody how to do the fourth step out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous? 6 guys over 10 years sober who are drunk. Because they have selfish sons of bitches. Got it and kept it. You know, you can come in here and get it. And what happens? It withers and dies. Well, I always ask people, how new is your newest pigeon? Mine's got 2 days. I've always got somebody with less than 2 weeks, and I don't have to fight my way to find them. The other day, a guy, a sponsor, he said, well, I can't find anybody to work with. And I said, well, as you were making a date on the sidewalk outside the meeting, I didn't have to push you to one side to get to the only newcomer in the meeting. And it's always like, there are plenty of pigeons. You know, they just shit on you and fly away and don't obey instructions. But it's all right. We talked about step. Oh, no, I just want to say something about step 5 because there's a lot of misunderstanding about it. I was in Sacramento many years ago and I got my new pigeon and he said to me, how can I trust you with the fifth step? Well, we'd met like 30 minutes before, we're having lunch in Denny's or somewhere, and we're talking about the steps, and he said, how can I trust you? He said, we've just been in a meeting, you talked about being a liar, a cheat, a thief, and a gossip in sobriety. I said, beat the shit out of me. I mean, how can you trust me? I mean, I wouldn't trust me. And then I told him the worst 3 things I'd ever done, and I said, now I have to trust you, you don't have to trust me. This is how we do it. We take a fifth step. I always take a fifth step before I listen to one. We talk about that stuff, you know? And if they miss out on some of the stuff, I remind them. Because nobody misses out on that stuff. You know? The stuff we don't want to talk about. I had a sponsor at one time, because Paul was the other side of the world. And I remember this guy talking at our home group, and he said, you know, there's a lot of popular stuff in AA. We talk about going to bed with Raquel Welsh and waking up with her grandmother, and everybody gets a laugh out of it. He said, but when you look across the pillow in the morning and you discover it's a fella and you wonder who owes who $5, it's not such a popular concept. Now, I've listened to many hundreds of fifth steps, and I'm waiting for somebody to miss when it gets dark in the middle of the night. Talked about the sixth step. I mean, I love what it says in the big book. Are you willing? No. Pray again. And then it doesn't say if you're now not willing, pray again. It just says go on. We say the seventh step prayer. I talked of my experience about smoking. First time I did the fifth step, I came home. She, the one who'd passed out drunk on the police station floor, was not yet sober. So she thought I'd been out with somebody else. She was accusatory, and I'm sensitive. And I picked up the big book, And it opened at step six. I'd just done my first ever fifth step. I read step six, and then I read that prayer, "My Creator, I'm now willing that you should take all of me, good and bad." And you see, I felt a lot better as I said that prayer. All of me, good and bad. My defects are none of my business. I cared about not smoking and not wanting to for all that time since I said that prayer. Step eight, I had great difficulty about this guy I killed in 1955. I talked about it the first time I did the fifth step. It was a drunken prank. I'll tell you exactly what happened, the exact nature of it, because when I first remembered it, I had forgotten about it for nearly 10 years. Not thought of it once. Booze is beautiful. Booze removes the thoughts. And I suddenly remembered it. I was a year sober, and I said to the guy next to me about having killed this guy, but I let you think it, you know, it was a knife fight, or I'd beaten him to death, or he'd run over him with a car or something, you know. I mean, I'm a macho sort of guy, you know. We can't have the drunken, stupid, practical joke that this was. Three of us coming back from a pub in the night, down a narrow road on the moors in Yorkshire, between two stone walls. We came to a farm loading bay and a lot of empty milk churns on there, and we put them across the road just as a fun prank. Foggy night, and a motorcyclist saw this barrier obviously break. I mean, I don't know the details, but he was dead, and I was responsible. The other two guys forgot that I was with them. I didn't say anything. They didn't get caught. And 14 years sober, I'm on the line. I don't know what to do. You know, I've got him in my eighth step now. What do I do? I sponsored a guy who run PCP from Mexico up to Canada and killed a lot of guys. A lot of kids had died through this. And he'd been sponsored before me by a guy who was obviously wise and who'd said, "You write a letter to those kids. It's all you can do, but it's all you can do." Now, sometimes people say, "Well, all I can do is pray." Yeah, all, with capital A, capital L, capital L, all I can do. So I wrote the victim on my step list, my updated one. And then I used but a very large proportion of the available funds. And let them worry, and you carry on with the steps. He was a lot wiser than I thought. I've made some amends, I've not made some amends, then I've had to make amends. Making amends to my sister came in a very strange form. I did the apology stuff. I lived with her for several months in my early sobriety. And I would send her tapes from America after I moved here 25 years ago. I would send her tapes of AA meetings, and she loved these. Now, I'd taken her to a meeting in January 1971, and she said, "What a wonderful place for you, Ben. You know, I'm the black sheep of the family," and she's this wonderful lady. I mean, the whole family trusts my sister. They make her executrix of their wills. All this stuff, you know. And I'm the bad guy. And so I took her to this meeting, and she didn't go to another meeting for 18 and a half years. But since then, she's been sober continuously. She didn't look like an alcoholic when I got sober. She certainly didn't look like an alcoholic when I was drinking. But she's as much an alcoholic as I've ever been. And she just took another 18 and a half years of drinking. And it's, people say, you know, you can't work with members of your family. Don't trust them. They'll lie to you about other stuff. When my dad died, we went back from the funeral and went back to his house, and, you know, just standing inside the door was the hired help with the champagne on the silver salver and all this stuff. Just imagine. Like at my home. And we hung around for a little while, and I said to my team, because I've got my team, you know, I'm it. And I said, "Let's get out of here." And we went down to the local country club, and we had tea there, and I looked around and I counted 7 members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it wasn't like that in 1970. It was not like that. And the amends have been difficult. Knocking on the door where you knew, where I knew, I don't say you, where I knew, the man behind the door wanted to kill me. And I haven't got all the money, but having to do it. And that's how we live. Step 10, I misread. I thought it said if we were wrong. That'll keep you in perpetual ignorance and stupidity. 17 years it took me to read when. I have prayed wrong and prayed badly for all of my sobriety. I meditated incredibly badly. Sometimes I meditate really well. But the important thing I have to share with people and you is the only thing I've done on a daily basis is not take anything. I know people who pray on their knees every day, and all I say to them is, what happens the day you don't? I do not believe in the cracks in the sidewalk type sobriety. I do not believe in superstition. I carry a rabbit's foot, but I don't believe in superstition. I believe that there are some days when I just don't pray. And it's okay. It's okay to just not pray. And some days I pray a lot. Some days I say wonderful prayers. I say the prayer of St. Francis a lot. I say the third step prayer a lot. Say it on my knees sometimes. I was out in Oklahoma about 18 months ago because my grandson, 14 years old, had emailed me. He's an old-timer in Alateen, 6 years in Alateen and 14 years old. And he said in the email, Grandpa, I need help with my fourth step. And I bought an airplane ticket. And I got there and he didn't know I was coming. We did his fourth step. He wrote it in the back of the book, and I said, what's all this, Christopher? And he said, it's a unique fourth step, Grandpa. And he's writing from the back coming forward. And I'm puzzled about this. And then I got it as he closed it. I said, it's so nobody can find it, isn't it? He said, uh-huh. And that afternoon, I was kneeling on the floor of my daughter's living room, holding hands with my grandson and my daughter, and we're saying the third step prayer. 31 years and 8,000 miles from Oxford Prison, but for the grace of God, I've never missed it all. I've now got a few minutes to talk about the 12th step, which has become a passion of mine. There was a guy called Chester Gifford who got sober in New York in 1946, and he came into my life. 1972, and this old man taught me a lot about Alcoholics Anonymous, and just changed my life. I saw this man when his son had he discovered his son. He married a woman of 26. The gossip was bad. You know, she was 4 years sober, and he was 27 years sober or something. All went chatter, chatter, chatter. And their firstborn was born with spina bifida. And I was at the meeting the night that he discovered this. And he sat at the end of the table and he talked about what they'd told him when he was new. And they told him to get time when bad news came. They told him to get time. And he'd gotten his car and he'd driven to one of the most beautiful views in England, a place called Box Hill, and he sat there. And here was a man who never talked about God. He talked about his higher power being the group. And he said something that was profound to me that night. There were maybe six of us at the meeting. And he said, when I take myself out of the equation, it always gets better. And he said how his son needed to be born and his son needed parents. And he said, when I take my feelings and my personality out of the equation, it's okay, because he needs his mother, and his mother was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she was an RN, and he said, I'm wise and old and quite well off, and I'm probably the best dad you could ever have. And it was a wonderful experience to see that living, and to know that I could do the same. When I take myself out of the equation, it's always okay. I've had fun with the problem. He said one night, there was a woman who said she'd been shopping that day, and she said it hadn't worked. And it was just... this was long before crosstalk was ever talked about in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Some of us got sober before the treatment center brought in all these catchphrases. We crosstalked. And somebody said something, we responded to it. Otherwise, we'd have had the meeting in a phone booth. He responded to this woman and he said, the obsessions of sobriety are wonderful, and he listed them. He talked about obsessive work and obsessive going to meetings, obsessive sex, obsessive masturbation, and I blushed. And then he said, these obsessions will keep you sober long enough for you to catch the magnificent obsession to not drink. And if you don't catch the magnificent obsession to help other people to not drink, you're not going to make it anyway. And I caught the magnificent obsession to not drink. And I've been doing this. And I love to do it. And I love to end my pitch with a couple of 12-step stories. And if you're new, go get your own 12-step stories. Just get out there and find drunks and work with them. I had breakfast the other day with three guys down in Sacramento who were all hopeless drunks 21 years ago, and they were 12-stepping one another, and I was trying to sponsor them all as they went round. You know, one day they'd be sober and they're taking another guy. And it's just a panic, frantic stuff. And we're having breakfast and we're talking. They're all over 20 years sober. 21 years ago they were doing it wrong. They're all over 20 years sober, all three of them. And one day we get this call, Herb Long and I, we go out. And just to remove the excuse, if somebody calls from the bar, you don't say, I won't go. This is what you say. Put the drink down and stand on the sidewalk. They say, when will you be coming past? And I say, none of your business. I will be past sometime in the next couple of hours. Stand on the sidewalk. And they say, what car are you driving? They don't mind. You're not standing on the sidewalk. I shan't slow down. Right? So we got one of these. He's in the Hofbrau on Arden Way in Sacramento. And he got most of the instructions right. But he was sitting on a case of Budweiser. It was 110 in the shade. And he came to hear me speak about 7 years later, and he was 7 years sober. We don't know who we're going to get. I was driving down the Fulham Road on a Sunday afternoon, and I had a guy with me called Huey Hunter. Huey and I have been doing AA since 1971 together, and Huey's a guy, he died some years ago, 24 years sober. Huey was an ex-professional soccer player, and his legs had been badly injured, and he had to go to hospital every day and get injections. He was on this course of injections. And we'd been to an AA conference that day, a mini conference, and we're just high on this conference, you know. We're there in the capital city of London, and driving down the Fulham Road, we pass this hospital. I said, that'll do, because any hospital would do. We go in there, we follow a drunk in there, he's been sort of half carried in, and Huey goes off with the nurse who's going to give him the injections, and I'm just standing there, you know. And there are capital cities, emergency wards, Sunday afternoon, it's where the drunks go. Always where the drunks go. If you want to do some 12-step work, go to the emergency ward on a Sunday afternoon in the capital city. You'll find some drunks. One of them had thrown up. There was a broken bottle. There was the guy we'd followed in drunk. Three of them. I am feeling discomfort. Shouldn't have felt discomfort. Everything's going well. New suit on. New Jaguar in the parking lot. Everything's good. Feel discomfort. Remember what Paul said? Always said to me, when in doubt, work with another alcoholic. So I look at these three drunks, very bad news. Lower class drunks, all drunk, not good prospects. So I said, dear God, which of these drunks should I work with? She walks past. She was a nurse, big headdress, like they have in England, starched white headdress, long legs, right up to her armpits. She was gorgeous. I fell into step behind her, just like Pavlov's dog. And I follow her to the front. She's the nurse in charge of the emergency room. I sit down. I said, have you got 5 minutes? Which, incidentally, if you're doing 12-step work, you meet a newcomer at a meeting, It's the opening remark. It's also, you know, it's the best close in the business. Have you got 5 minutes? Do not say, have you got 3 hours to discuss the steps, traditions, and concepts? Just, have you got 5 minutes? They can't say no to that. So I said, have you got 5 minutes? She said, yes. I told her about Alcoholics Anonymous. She interrupted me. She said, I went to the hospital psychiatrist last Monday. I called AA, didn't get through. I was the first ever sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous she'd ever spoken to. And the following night, we had her in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And God had taken care, taken advantage of my baser defect of character. One more 12-step story because it's near to here. Folsom, California on a Wednesday night. I've always been willing to go on a 12-step calls on my own. And so should you, because it says so in the book. If Bill hadn't gone on his own, none of us would have been here. You know, people will tell you at the meetings about the guy with the gun, and be careful. Big Book says, if you're on the firing line of life, God will keep you unharmed. I don't need a policy from the Prudential. I need that sentence. I sat next to the guy with a loaded 38 on a 12-step call. He was playing with the electric train set, and he had a jug of vodka and a loaded 38. And he'd been in AA until he'd been in a car wreck, and a friendly doctor had given him Librium. We got into a meeting the next night, and I don't know what's happened. Anyway, I'm going to this call on my own on a Wednesday night because I couldn't get anybody in time, and I drove past the Wednesday night meeting out there in Folsom, California, and they're just coming out of the AA meeting, and I drive into the parking lot, and there are two of my best friends in the world, Bobby Burton and a guy called Whitey, who some of you know from Paloma over here. And there they are. And I said, jump in, we've got a 12-step call. So we go out, and we see this guy called Ted, and he's very drunk. I mean, really drunk. Not a good prospect. I mean, definitely not a good prospect. We sit down. He is not listening. We each give a 10-minute pitch, 30 minutes. We're up and gone. We're walking out, and he said, you're good people. By this time, he's vertical. He said, you're good people. And I said something like, yeah, beat the fire department, didn't we? And he said, no, the dog didn't bite you. I hadn't seen a dog. We hadn't seen a dog. This is a savage dog. It's a little dachshund that savaged people, and it's licking Whitey's hand. He locked it in the garage every time they had visitors, but he was too drunk to remember. Dog knows we're about our father's business, licking Whitey's hand. I look down, licks my hand, we're okay. And this is a stupid story. I mean, really stupid. But because the dog didn't attack us, Ed was on his front porch the next night at 7:30 when I pulled up to take him to his first ever AA meeting. And the last time Whitey saw him, he was in Carson City, Nevada, and he was 10 years sober. So go on the 12-step call, go alone, go with people, go sober, and make sure the dog doesn't bite you. Thank you very much.